Hello and welcome to today's reading of the New York Times. We'll start with the front page article from the Tuesday, April 23rd edition. It carries the headline, University Struggle as Pro-Palestinian Demonstrations Grow. Dozens were arrested Monday at NYU and Yale, but officials there and at campuses across the country are running out of options to corral protests that are expected to last the rest of the school year. At New York University, the police swept in to arrest protesting students on Monday night, ending a standoff with the school's administration. At Yale, the police placed protesters' wrists into zip ties on Monday morning and escorted them onto campus shuttles to receive summonses for trespassing. Columbia kept its classroom doors closed on Monday, moving lectures online and urging students to stay home. Harvard Yard was shut to the public. Nearby, at campuses like Tufts and Emerson, administrators weighed how to handle encampments that looked much like the ones the police dismantled at Columbia last week, which protesters quickly resurrected. And on the West Coast, a new encampment bubbled at the University of California, Berkeley. Less than a week after the arrest of more than 100 protesters at Columbia, administrators at some of the country's most influential universities were struggling, and largely failing, to calm campuses torn by the conflict in Gaza and Israel. During the turmoil on Monday, which coincided with the start of Passover, protesters called on their universities to become less financially tied to Israel and its arms suppliers. Many Jewish students agonized anew over some protests and chants that veered into anti-Semitism and feared again for their safety. Some faculty members denounced clampdowns on peaceful protests and warned that academia's mission to promote open debate felt imperiled. Alumni and donors raged. And from Congress, there were calls for the resignation of Columbia's president, Nemet Shafik. From some of the same lawmakers, Dr. Shafik tried to pacify last week with words and tactics that inflamed her own campus. The menu of options for administrators handling protests seems to be quickly dwindling. It's all but certain that the demonstrations, in some form or another, will last on some campuses until the end of the academic year. And even then, graduation ceremonies may be bitterly contested gatherings. For now, with the most significant protests confined to a handful of campuses, the administrators' approach sometimes seems to shift from hour to hour. I know that there is much debate about whether or not we should use police on campus, and I'm happy to engage in those discussions, Dr. Shafik said in a message to students and employees early Monday, 4 days after officers dressed in riot gear helped clear part of Columbia's campus. But I do know that better adherence to our rules and effective enforcement mechanisms would obviate the need for relying on anyone else to keep our community safe, she added. We should be able to do this ourselves. Protesters have demonstrated with varying intensity since the October 7th Hamas attack on Israel, but this particular round of unrest began to gather greater force last Wednesday after Columbia students erected an encampment, just as Dr. Shafik was preparing to testify before Congress. At that hearing in Washington before a Republican-led House committee, she vowed to punish unauthorized protests on the private university's campus more aggressively, and the next day she asked the New York Police Department to clear the encampment. In addition to more than 100 people arrested, Columbia suspended many students. Many Columbia professors, students, and alumni voiced fears that the university was stamping out free debate, a cornerstone of the American college experience. Moving to our next article, an unprecedented trial opens with two visions of Trump. The prosecution's opening statement sketched a seamy scheme meant to further the election of Donald J. Trump. His lawyers said the government's case is merely, quote, 34 pieces of paper, end quote. Manhattan prosecutors delivered a raw recounting of Donald Trump's seamy past on Monday as they debuted their case against him to jurors, the nation, and the world, reducing the former president to a co-conspirator in a plot to cover up three sex scandals that threatened his 2016 election win. Their opening statement was a pivotal moment in the first prosecution of an American president, a sweeping synopsis of the case against Mr. Trump, who watched from the defense table, occasionally shaking his head. Moments later, Mr. Trump's lawyer delivered his own opening, beginning with a simple claim that President Trump is innocent, then noting that he is once again the presumptive Republican nominee, and concluding with an exhortation for jurors to, quote, use your common sense, end quote. The jury of 12 New Yorkers will weigh Mr. Trump's legal fate before millions of voters decide his political future. Also heard brief testimony from the prosecution's leadoff witness, David Pecker, former tabloid publisher who was close with Mr. Trump. Mr. Pecker, who ran the National Enquirer, testified that his supermarket tabloids practiced checkbook journalism. In this case, prosecutors say he bought and buried stories that could have imperiled Mr. Trump's 2016 campaign. The flurry of activity on the landmark trial's first formal day captivated jurors, many of whom jotted notes as they followed along. And it sent nervous energy through a lower Manhattan courtroom as bomb-sniffing dogs, U.S. Secret Service, and police patrolled the dingy building. The spectacle was a vivid reminder of the proceedings' unprecedented nature. Courthouse accustomed to cycling through trials of murderers, fraudsters, and felons of all types, now had its first former president. On Monday, the trial ended early and with little fanfare to accommodate the Passover holiday and a juror's emergency dental appointment. But it began in striking fashion, with the judge, Juan Marchand, determining what prosecutors could ask of Mr. Trump should he take the witness stand in his own defense. A victory for the prosecution, the judge ruled that they could question him about three civil trials he lost over the last year, including a fraud case in which a different judge found him liable for conspiring to inflate his net worth and penalized him hundreds of millions of dollars. Matthew Colangelo, a senior aide to the Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, then seized on what he called a conspiracy in the criminal case. Over the course of a 45-minute opening, as Mr. Bragg watched from the front row, Mr. Colangelo calmly walked the jury through the prosecution's argument that Mr. Trump orchestrated the plot to corrupt the 2016 election. The scheme, he explained, involved hush money deals with three people who had salacious stories to sell: porn star, Playboy model, and a doorman at one of Mr. Trump's buildings. Mr. Trump, who faces up to 4 years in prison, directed allies to buy those people's silence to protect his candidacy, Mr. Colangelo explained. Mr. Pecker took care of the model and the doorman, while Michael Cohen, Mr. Trump's former fixer, who was set to be the prosecution's star witness, paid off the porn star. After taking the White House, Mr. Colangelo added, Mr. Trump agreed to cook the books to cover up Mr. Cohen's $130,000 payment to the porn star, Stormy Daniels. When Mr. Trump reimbursed Mr. Cohen, Mr. Colangelo said, Mr. Trump and his company falsified internal records, disguising the repayments as routine legal expenses. Mr. Trump faces 34 felony counts for falsifying business records, one for each false check, ledger, and invoice. The former president lied over and over and over again, Mr. Colangelo emphatically said, casting him as a conniving criminal. But Mr. Trump's lawyer, Todd Blanche, sought to undercut the prosecution's lofty rhetoric with a more innocuous distillation of the case, calling it a, quote, business records violation, end quote, that wasn't. Instead, he said it was just 34 pieces of paper. Mr. Blanche placed blame on Mr. Cohen, who had hashed out the reimbursement plan with Mr. Trump's company, and pleaded guilty to federal charges for his role. Mr. Blanche contended that, quote, President Trump had nothing to do with the invoice, end quote. Previewing what is likely to be a recurring motif, Mr. Blanche took aim at Mr. Cohen's credibility, noting that he is a criminal and arguing that he's a scorned former employee who will stop at nothing to put Mr. Trump in prison. Our next article, United Kingdom approves bill that would send asylum seekers to Rwanda. Britain's Parliament passed contentious legislation to allow the deportation of asylum seekers to the African country, a political victory for Prime Minister Rishi Sunak. Britain's Conservative government finally won passage of its flagship immigration policy on Monday, enshrining a Rwanda deportation bill that human rights campaigners say is inhumane, immigration experts say is unworkable, and legal critics say has corroded the country's reputation for rule of law. The legislation is designed to allow the government to put some asylum seekers on one-way flights to Rwanda, where they would have their claims processed by the authorities in that Central African country. If they were then granted refugee status, they would be resettled in Rwanda, not Britain. From the moment the plan was first introduced in 2022, under then Prime Minister Boris Johnson, experts said it would breach Britain's human rights obligations under domestic and international law. Even after the passage of the new bill, which came under heavy opposition from the House of Lords and effectively overrides a ruling by Britain's Supreme Court, any deportation attempts are likely to encounter a flurry of further legal challenges, making it unlikely that a large number of asylum seekers will ever be sent to Rwanda. Yet the current Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, insisted on Monday that the government would operate multiple charter flights every month, starting in 10 to 12 weeks. These flights will go, come what may, feisty Mr. Sunak said hours before the final vote. This is novel, he said of the policy. It is innovative, but it will be a game changer. The plan's tortured journey into law speaks mostly to the state of politics in post-Brexit Britain. A divided Conservative Party, desperate to exploit anxiety about immigration to close a polling gap with the opposition Labour Party, has clung to the policy for 2 years, despite legal setbacks and deep doubts about its expense and viability. While it's conceivable the government could get some flights off the ground before a general election expected in the fall, it would have only done so at the cost of hundreds of millions of pounds and, critics say, a blot on the country's reputation as a bulwark of international and human rights laws. It pushes every button, the limits of executive power, the role of the House of Lords, the courts, the conflict between domestic and international law, said Jill Roter, a senior research fellow at UK in a Changing Europe, a research institute. You're playing constitutional constraints bingo with this policy. Not only did the plan bring Mr. Sunak into conflict with civil servants, opposition politicians, and international courts, it led the government to overrule the Supreme Court. In the process, critics say, effectively inventing its own facts. The new legislation writes into law that Rwanda is a, quote, safe country, end quote, for refugees, defying the court's judgment based on substantial evidence that it is not. The legislation instructs judges and immigration officials to conclusively treat the Republic of Rwanda as a safe country and gives the government the power to disregard future rulings by international courts. There are no provisions to amend it if conditions in Rwanda change. While the African nation has made strides politically and socially in recent decades, even sympathetic observers point out that it was convulsed by genocide during a civil war in 1994 and is now ruled by an increasingly authoritarian leader, Paul Kagame. Those who publicly challenge him risk arrest, torture, or death. You can't make a country safe just by saying it's safe, said David Anderson, barrister and member of the House of Lords, who is not affiliated with any party who opposed the law. That is absolutely absurd. Given all these liabilities, the surprise is that Mr. Sunak embraced the plan as a means to fulfill his promise to stop the boats. British newspapers reported he had been skeptical of it when he was Chancellor of the Exchequer under Mr. Johnson. Political analysts say Mr. Sunak's decision reflected pressure from the right of his party, where support for sending refugees to Rwanda is strong. but he spent significant political capital in the long campaign to pass the legislation and missed his self-imposed deadline of starting the flights by spring. The often bitter debate exposed rifts between Tory lawmakers, with moderates warning that the bill went too far, while hardliners complained it did not go far enough. In the latest act of this legislative drama, the House of Commons and its unelected counterpart, the House of Lords, tried unsuccessfully to attach amendments to it, including one that would require an independent monitoring group to verify Rwanda was safe. On Monday, the Lords capitulated on the last of those amendments. That cleared the way for the Commons to pass the legislation known as the Safety of Rwanda Bill. Government said it addressed the Supreme Court's concerns through a treaty with the Rwandans last December, but critics said the British government had still failed to guarantee that refugees could not someday be returned to their countries of origin, where they might suffer political violence or ill treatment. That Mr. Johnson championed the plan was less surprising, given his bombastic, freewheeling style, which upended the cautious, evidence-based tradition of British policymaking. It was also a legacy of Brexit, for which Mr. Johnson had campaigned when he promised in 2016 to, quote, take back control, end quote, of the country's borders. Every time a small boat bounces in and you can't get rid of the people, it is symbolic of the fact that you haven't really taken back control, said Ms. Rutter, who labeled the policy an illegitimate child of Brexit. Before Brexit, Britain cooperated with France in nearly eliminating the flow of those who crossed the English Channel by stowing away on trucks, but Mr. Johnson's relations with President Emmanuel Macron of France were icy, and after leaving the European Union, Britain had fewer levers with which to pressure Paris. At times, British government's desperation to curb the stream of barely seaworthy vessels seemed almost comical, such as when reports emerged that it was considering trying to repel them with giant wave machines. Another story from today's New York Times. Supreme Court seems poised to allow local laws that penalize homelessness. A majority of the justices appeared skeptical of courts wading into the thorny policy questions around when local governments can punish people for sleeping and camping outdoors. A majority of the Supreme Court appeared inclined on Monday to uphold a series of local ordinances that allowed a small Oregon city to ban homeless people from sleeping or camping in public spaces. The justices seemed split along ideological lines in the case, which has sweeping implications for how the country deals with a growing homelessness crisis. In a lengthy and, at times, fiery argument that lasted almost 2.5 hours, questioning from the justices reflected the complexity of the homelessness debate. They weighed the status of poverty and the civil rights of homeless people against the ability of cities to clear public spaces like parks and sidewalks to address concerns about health and safety. They wrestled with what lines could be drawn to regulate homelessness and, crucially, who should make those rules. The conservative majority appeared sympathetic to arguments by the city of Grants Pass, Oregon, that homelessness is a complicated issue best handled by local lawmakers and communities, not judges. Liberal justices strongly resisted that notion. Chief Justice John Roberts calmly cut to the central point that seemed to resonate with the conservative wing. Why would you think that these 9 people are the best people to judge and weigh those policy judgments? In impassioned questioning, the liberal justices pushed back sharply on the city's argument that homelessness was not a status protected under the 8th Amendment's prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. Could you criminalize the status of homelessness? Justice Elena Kagan asked the city's lawyer, Theon Evangelis. Well, I don't think that homelessness is a status like drug addiction, Ms. Evangelis responded. Homelessness is a status, Justice Kagan replied. It's the status of not having a home. The issue of how far local governments can go to regulate homelessness has given rise to unusual alliances across the political spectrum, with some leaders of the left-leaning cities and states joining with conservative groups to urge the justices to clarify the extent of their legal authority in clearing encampments that have proliferated across the West in recent years. Many leaders in Western states and cities have contended that the decisions by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, which oversees nine Western states, have been interpreted in ways that have limited the flexibility of governments to tackle the problem. The case stems from a series of local ordinances in Grants Pass, a town of about 40,000 in southern Oregon. City officials stepped up enforcement of local laws in 2013 after residents began to complain about people sleeping, urinating, and defecating outside. Three homeless residents of Grants Pass challenged those ordinances in 2018, arguing the city had violated the Eighth Amendment. Grants Pass contended that the Eighth Amendment was the wrong framework because it typically aimed at punishments, not at laws. It added that a Supreme Court ruling striking down its ordinances would set a troubling precedent that would tie the hands of local governments around the country and fuel sprawling encampments. The case is among the last to be argued in this term, which means that it is unlikely to be decided before late June, perhaps early July, since the Supreme Court now has a backlog of pending decisions in major cases. As arguments were underway, about 100 demonstrators protested outside the court, chanting, "SCOTUS, now's the time, homelessness is not a crime," holding signs that read, "Housing justice" and "Housing is a human right." Kelsey Cochran, lawyer representing the homeless plaintiffs, asserted that the use of the Eighth Amendment in the case was appropriate, therefore an issue the court was suited to address. "I don't think there's any question that being poor is a status," she said. "It's a status that can change over time, and at that point you wouldn't be part of the class, but I don't think it changes the fact that it is a status." In heated questioning with the lawyer for the city, Justice Kagan pointed to the city's ordinances that allow the authorities to ticket people for sleeping with bedding in public, asking whether cities could outlaw other basic human needs, like breathing. "Sleeping is a biological necessity," Justice Kagan said. "It's sort of like breathing. I mean, you could say that breathing is conduct, too, but presumably you would not think that it's okay to criminalize breathing in public. And for a homeless person who has no place to go, sleeping in public is kind of like breathing in public." Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson made similar analogy, asking whether a city could prohibit eating in public because of concerns about sanitation, trash, and rodents. "Most people would be fine," she said, "because they could just eat at restaurants or somewhere indoors, but not everyone." "Some people don't have that option," Justice Jackson said. "They have to eat in public because they're unhoused and they can't afford to go to a restaurant." And now let's move to today's Metro section. Our first Metro section story: as floods beckon, many of New York's catch basin trucks were offline. A report by the New York City Comptroller's Office found big gaps in how the administration of Mayor Eric Adams handles emergency preparations. 7 months after New York City was inundated by more than 8 inches of rain, an investigation found that the city's public communications were, in some cases, quote, "woefully limited," end quote, and its infrastructure inadequate to the challenges of extreme weather. The 44-page investigation by the office of Brad Lander, the New York City comptroller, noted that 63% of the Department of Environmental Protection's 51 specialized catch basin cleaning trucks, key part of the city's arsenal to prevent floods, were out of service when the storm hit. And though city officials began monitoring the storm a week before its arrival and activated its flash flood emergency plan the morning before, that proactive approach was not as effectively extended to public communications, the report reads. The mayor did not hold a news conference on the storm until nearly 3 hours after heavy rain began. The Department of Education did not directly communicate any information to students' families about the weather in advance of the storm, according to the comptroller. While the city's opt-in emergency alert system sent out notices, most New Yorkers did not subscribe to the flash flood warnings. Only 2.7% of New Yorkers over 16 years of age, 185,895 people, received Notify NYC emergency alerts for the flash flood event, according to the report. The investigation comes amid continued scrutiny of New York City's emergency response efforts. When an earthquake rattled the city this month, it took officials 26 minutes to issue an alert. Last June, Mayor Eric Adams faced criticism for failing to adequately warn New Yorkers about toxic air wafting in from Canadian wildfires. Extreme storms, thankfully, don't hit every day, but you have to be preparing for them every day, Mr. Landers said, and this report is evidence that the city needs to be doing a better job with that. The investigation examined the city's progress delivering on three sets of recommendations issued after Hurricane Ida in 2021, when heavy rain inundated the city, killing 13 New Yorkers. It was the first time the National Weather Service has declared a flash flood emergency for the city. 2 years later, when rain tied to Tropical Storm Ophelia hit New York, the city suffered an estimated $100 million in economic losses, as the storm revealed what the comptroller's office described as, quote, serious shortcomings, end quote, in the city's response. The night before the storm, the National Weather Service warned of possible flash flooding, predicted up to 5 inches of rain in parts of New York City. The city's sewer system cannot handle more than 1.75 inches of rain an hour. By 9 a.m. the next day, parts of Brooklyn were seeing more than 3 inches of rain an hour. Subways were shut down. More than 500 public school buildings suffered flood damage. Woodhull Hospital, a public hospital in Brooklyn, had to disconnect its electric supply and evacuate. City officials did try to warn basement residents, among the most vulnerable to flash flooding, but by the comptroller's estimate, the city's basement notifications list encompassed less than 1% of the people live in basements. At the time of the storm, nearly 2 years into the mayor's administration, the mayor had not appointed an extreme weather coordinator, according to the comptroller. The position was created during Bill de Blasio's administration after Hurricane Ida. In March, City Hall notified the comptroller's office that it had named Camille Joseph Varlock, the mayor's chief of staff, to fill that position. And we'll wrap up with a bit of an upbeat article. How to find New York City's cherry blossoms. Some cherry trees have already begun to bloom, but there are still weeks of pink and white flowers ahead. After months of dreary weather and bare branches, it's finally cherry blossom season in New York City. This means that roughly 35,000 ornamental cherry trees around the city will be bursting with white and pink petals for the next month or so, drawing thousands of people outside to enjoy them. Here's an overview of what kind of cherry blossoms are in New York City, when they'll bloom, and where you can find them. First, when is peak cherry blossom season? Most of New York's cherry trees are in bloom by mid-April, though for certain types it can be a bit earlier or later. Once a tree starts blooming, it'll hold its blossoms for about 10 days. When exactly each tree begins to flower can be hard to predict and depends on the temperature and the amount of daylight it receives. Because the past few winters have been relatively mild, the city's cherry trees have been blooming a little earlier than usual. This year at the Brooklyn Botanic Gardens, the first bloom was recorded March 10th, Shauna Moore, the garden's director of horticulture, said. But peak bloom, when rows and rows of vibrant pink flowers appear on the garden's cherry esplanade and cherry walk, is still a few weeks away. Visitors can check Cherry Watch, an online tracker run by garden staff members, to keep tabs on when the blooms might arrive. And that's all we have time for today. I've been reading from the Tuesday, April 23rd edition of the New York Times. We thank you for listening. So long until next time.